Welcome back to yet another sparkling edition of the Two Mics on the Record podcast. Mr. Mike Porky Parry is here.
Yeah, certainly am, yeah.
And so am I. I'm Mike Graham,
yeah,
of course.
Okay.
Now it's time, because we haven't done it for a while.
Yeah.
I prefer to call it the Porky Review of Books.
Porky Review
of
Books.
And you know why I like to call it that, because that is the term that links it more closely with the New York Times.
Yes.
Which it has, of course, the New York Times Review of Books.
Yes, that's right, yes. And we are of that level.
We certainly are.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to get a bit serious for once, okay, on this podcast, but there's a book which has come out, and I've already read bits of it, you know, book was sent to me, and it's written by a woman who fell off a horse. Her name is Melanie Reed.
Melanie Reed, I know Melanie Reed. She's Scottish, isn't she?
She's Scottish.
She used to write, I think I'm right in saying, for the Herald in Scotland.
Yes, that's right.
And then I think she went to the Times.
Yes.
She
now writes for the Times.
I was going to say, yeah, she writes for the Times.
She writes a column in the Sunday Times column magazine, in the Times Saturday column magazine called Spinal Column.
Yes.
And she writes another column about general bits and pieces, or, you know, general, like, columnist column. On a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, or something, in the Times on their op-ed page, you know.
It's a very tragic story, her story, but she's been very brave and continued to write
well
and make her living as a journalist, despite the fact that she's now, I think, is it quadriplegic or a
tetraplegic?
Tetraplegic.
She's
tetraplegic. What's that?
It means that it's not quite as bad as quadriplegic. Means nothing from the neck down. Tetraplegic means from the waist down, so you actually can use your arms.
Oh, okay.
And
so she can type.
Yeah, but no, she can't actually. She can, but because her spinal column was so badly damaged, only like two of her fingers work on one hand and one finger on the other. I mean, she's terribly badly incapacitated.
Yeah.
And it's such a terrible tragedy because she was a very active woman. She lived in this remote part of Scotland where she used to take her horse out and go galloping around the fields.
Yeah.
She comes to a little hedge, right, with her big horse. And she said, I've jumped that sort of thing thousands of times. And at the last moment, the horse didn't want to go over the hedge.
It was a bit like the Christopher Reeve accident, which we all saw on TV.
That's right.
Because it was being filmed at the time.
That's right.
And it was just a kind of a three-day event thing that he was doing.
That's right.
And it didn't seem like anything, did it? The horse kind of stopped and he fell off forwards.
This book is amazing. It's called a memoir. It's about Melanie Reed. And it's called The World I Fell Out Of by Melanie Reed.
Right.
Now, I remember when it first happened to her, because it happened in 2010.
Yeah.
Her first columns, and she was in hospital for a year. She couldn't even function for a year.
Yeah.
And then moved back to her home. Her husband is a victim as well, because the home had to be converted for a disabled person in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And some of her first columns were about her sitting in front of the mirror for hours and hours and hours and just crying.
They were quite angry as well, a lot of them.
Yeah.
She wrote an awful lot of very angry columns. It was quite hard to read, actually, at the time.
About trying to get used to her fate.
Yeah. Well, also just how awful it was and how she felt very sorry for herself.
Yes.
I mean, it was interesting
to
read.
Yeah, all of that.
Because I never knew her very well, but I think when I was in Scotland in the Mirror days, which was up to 2005, I think that's when she wrote for the Herald.
That's right.
So I used to see her at things. You know?
Right, okay, yeah. But she was a tall, attractive woman. She sort of woman who was the life and soul of the party, loved a glass of champagne with her friends and all that. Loved the countryside she lived in and all that. As you said, rightly said, now I admire her enormously because now she is coming to terms with it after 10 years or 8 years at the moment. I would never come to terms with it. I could never ever accept it. I could not possibly accept it in any form whatsoever. I would literally, and this isn't being offensive to anybody else, get my sister to take me to Beachy Head and leave the brake off the wheelchair. Oh, that's all I'd want.
Yeah, but you say that now, right?
Yeah, I do say it.
And
now.
It might be different if it actually did happen to you, because I think people say a lot of things like that. I mean, my mother, for example, used to say to me, or, you know, if I ever become, you know, more or less infirm or a nuisance, I'll just take a pill.
That's right.
Just get me one of those pills.
Or put the blanket over me, put a pillow over my face.
And I said to her, well, you say that, but one, you have to think about whether we would want you to do it.
Yes.
And two, you have to be, you know, in a pretty bad place. Now, when she had her accident last year, and she was, you know, I mean, she's recovered well.
Yes.
But she was potentially going to be stuck in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
She suddenly stopped talking about taking the pill.
Yeah.
She didn't say, you know, just let me pass away. Mm. She didn't want to go anywhere.
No.
She wanted to stay quite where she was, thank you.
Yeah, you know, America's oldest man's just died, 112.
Has he?
112.
Where was he?
He was a... he fought in the Second World War in one of those GI black units.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
He's a black man.
Right.
And can you believe he was born? He was born to a man who was a slave.
Right.
But lived long enough to see America's first black president.
All right.
How about that?
That's pretty good.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah.
That's some turnaround.
But anyway, look, getting back to this, you see, so she says, my horse had refused a piddly little jump on a piddly little day at a horse society instruction day. Harmless, happy people like me. That day, my steady, handsome chestnut horse didn't want to do it. It was a small jump. At the takeoff stride, which I suppose is the moment at which you're supposed to leap, He ducked out sharply, but I carried on going.
Right.
My foolish pride made me try to stay on by gripping his neck. It's the worst possible thing I could have done because it meant my arms were behind me when I hit the ground in front of me. The greatest fear of a rider, if you read this book, is being ejected from your horse without having your hands in front of you to cushion your blow.
Yeah.
And exactly the same thing happened with Christopher Reeve.
Right.
If your hands are still wrapped around your reins and you go off your horse, then Christopher Reeve described it as being a hammer hitting a nail on the head.
Right.
At the moment, your head hits the ground.
Yeah.
That's it. You crush all your vertebrae.
Right.
You break your spine.
But why is that? Because you're holding your arm. I'm trying to work out why your arms would be behind you.
Well, because if you're on a horse and you've got the reins wrapped around your hand.
And you go over.
You go over. You can't get your hands out. Your hands are behind you.
Oh, I see.
You,
yeah,
your head
gotcha.
Hits
yeah.
the ground, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying that, you know. And
it all happened so quickly as well.
Yeah. She said, wedged face down, I could taste dry, gritty, late winter Perthshire soil. She lives in Perthshire.
Yeah.
And I realised I couldn't move anything but my right arms and shoulders. She described it as I experienced a blinding red flash and felt my whole body suffuse with the most beautiful, intense feeling of warmth, my own internal nuclear explosion, my own terrible mushroom cloud. In the split seconds of consciousness I had left, I was already aware that my life, as I knew it, had ended.
Wow.
I mean, that is emotional stuff.
Isn't it?
And you're absolutely right.
So do you think she knew how badly injured she was then?
Yes, she did. She says, the one thing she said as well in part of this book is, her second most relevant thought was, that's the end of my sex life.
Yeah.
She'd never have sex again.
Right.
Because her body didn't function below her chest, you know what I mean?
Right.
And
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if she felt pain, because she's not describing pain there, is she?
She didn't feel pain at the time, because she says that she reached down and her fingers could feel the rough of her riding breeches. You see what I mean?
Right.
But her leg didn't respond to her fingers below that, so she knew she was paralysed somewhere, but not quite how bad it was.
That's awful, isn't it?
In hospital for a year, and even now... I mean, if you read her column every week, as I have done, a lot of it's in the book.
Yeah.
Things like, you know, you see a person sitting in a wheelchair, they just wheel them around. No. They have all sorts of things like bed sores because they're sitting in the chair all the time.
Uh-huh.
They get constant infections of their bladder system because if you're obviously paralysed below the chest, you have to have all sorts of catheters and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And you get infections all the time because germs get in and all that kind of stuff. And it's horrendous.
And you also need somebody to look after you.
All the time.
Which is the other thing that you might find difficult.
All the time. You know. You have to have carers. You have to have somebody to get out of bed and put you back into bed. I mean, most horrendous existence. I couldn't do it.
No.
I admire her so much.
But, I mean, you have to admire a lot of people who are in those kinds of situations.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got friends, the guys that I told you about that I hadn't seen since I was more or less a teenager that I used to work with, they've got a very autistic son.
Right.
Who is basically wheelchair bound.
Yeah.
He's now 31, right?
Yeah.
And they still, even to this day, lift him out of his bed every day, put him in his wheelchair, put him back in his bed at night, you know, care for him.
Yeah.
I'm in such awe of people who do that kind of thing because I just couldn't do it.
So am I.
I'd find it so hard. But talking about pain is interesting. Yeah. I mean, you've been through an awful lot of medical scenarios,
I have.
Right? I remember I've been fortunate in my life. I've only really once ever done anything bad, which is when I broke my wrist playing football.
Sure.
And I remember, and I was playing at Spitalfields, five a side, and I was still working the Express.
Yeah.
And I was going to block a shot by Robert Jobson, who was playing against me.
Quite a weight old Jobbo.
And he was a good footballer in those days as well. He used to play a bit, his dad used to own Southend.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And he was a kind of semi pro at one point. Sure, you know, he was pretty good.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was, for some reason, absolutely convinced that I wasn't going to let him shoot the ball at the goal.
Right.
And I was running full pelt, and I put my my foot out to block the ball.
Yeah.
And it was one of those soft balls.
Yeah, yeah.
And I stood on it and just went over.
Right.
Landed on my my wrist.
Horrible, yeah.
You know, with all the weight of my body the wrong way.
Mm.
And all it felt like at the time was a kind of almost like a turn of a screwdriver or something. It wasn't painful at all.
Yeah.
But I kind of knew it wasn't right.
Right.
And about 10 minutes it took before it started to feel really heavy.
Yeah.
And that was when I realised I'd broken it.
Right.
And it wasn't really painful for at least an hour.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And of course the woman in the Spitalfields place was like, oh yeah, you'll be all right, darling.
Yeah.
Just go home and put some frozen peas on it.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
But it was fucking broken. Since I got home, my then wife said, that's broken, we're going to the hospital.
Yeah, exactly.
So I did.
Good job you were looked after.
But I never. But it wasn't really that painful, is what I'm saying. But I broke it.
I've never really suffered great pain.
Mm.
The greatest pain I've suffered is toothache.
Because that can be terrible.
When I remember I was in Manchester working for the Express, right? You know, there I was one day just getting pissed somewhere, something, eating something, and realising half a tooth had crumbled.
Mm.
And that had released a filling. So there was a hole into your nerve. You see what I mean?
And so even when you breathe in, exactly. It's sore.
And saliva went into it and all that, you know. And I went to work the next day and I said, fucking hell. But that night was so painful.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
I should have got
pain.
A bottle of vodka and just whiskey.
Well, anything, you know. And because we were the Daily Express, we had access to dentists and that kind of stuff. And got it. But I remember that 24 hours was so painful.
No, you're right. Toothache, I think, is probably one of the worst pains of all.
I agree. But otherwise, although my heart has plagued me now for like 15 years, the pain is not pain. It's the fear of how, you know, bad the deterioration is getting and all that kind of stuff. You know, you get periods of breathlessness and all that kind of stuff. It's actually painful.
Yeah.
So
your heart's never really hurt, as it were.
Sometimes you get a pain. And it's,
you ever get that pain in your arm that they say you get before you have a heart attack?
No, I've never had that. I've never had that. But you can so easily confuse indigestion with a heart attack. And the two are linked because some mornings if I get up, my heart's not working properly. Yeah. My digestive system doesn't work because the second most important thing your heart does in your body, apart from pumping blood around it, is work your digestive system.
Okay.
And sometimes I've literally started to eat something and I realise by the time it's got to my gullet, it's not going anywhere.
Right.
And then it gets very painful.
Yeah.
And you don't know whether.
And that's what they call heartburn, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you don't know if it's indigestion or. But so far, it's not a heart attack. But anyway.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's a bit of a downer, that one. But I do admire Melanie an awful lot. But
it must be uplifting at the end, hopefully.
Not really, because she's still in. I remember terrible things. Like, for instance, she's an outdoor woman, okay? Mm. And so she'd gallop across these fields around her home in Perthshire, and then she'd bring her horse back, and they'd sit around a log fire and sip whiskey and all that kind of stuff, you know. And she liked doing it in the rain.
Yeah.
You know, she loved the rain in her face. And then the first time she tried to get into a car in the rain, the situation to get her in the back was a wooden bench.
Mm.
And she was lifted out of her wheelchair onto the bench
right.
and then had to slide across the bench into the car.
Right.
They'd done it once or twice successfully. On this day, it was raining.
Right.
And when it rained, the bench got stuck.
Right.
She couldn't slide across the bench. And then, you know, it's things like that, which mean that every day there's a new problem to encounter with the sort of... I remember reading about... it's quite a famous story about a kid who was a rugby player. He became a tetraplegic and turned to rugby coaching.
Uh-huh.
Right? You remember him?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah. And again, yes and no. Yes, I admire the boy for doing it, but you're such a freak within the rugby community.
Mm.
Is it worth it? You know what I mean? And I don't mean freak in the sense that I'm knocking him.
No.
I'm saying you are so different to everybody else. How can you make it
well,
work?
Well, I mean, not, luckily now people are a lot less prejudiced about it as well.
Of course they are.
They don't look at you and think, oh, look, there's somebody in a wheelchair. They must not be able to do anything.
No, no.
Because there's lots that they can do.
Of course they can. You know. See, by the way, that one of the nurses looked after Stephen Hawking is being investigated.
Oh, what, for beating him up?
Years after his death, yeah.
Well, I mean, apparently some of those people that looked after Stephen Hawking were not very nice.
After his money, maybe, allegedly.
Brief history of time.
But we don't want to say that, do we? Now, let's go to an upper of a book, shall we?
Let's do it in a minute.
This is a book review.
Let's do it in a minute.
Let's do it in a minute. I think we've got plenty of time to do it now, you know? You know? It's a quick one. Or do you want to do it in a minute? We'll do it in a minute. All right, you want to do it in a minute? We'll do it in a minute.
In a minute. So we've had a minute. So
right.
Let's hear it.
Right. This is called A Fabulous Creation, How the LP Saved Our Lives, okay? This is a book.
The LP as in the long player.
As in the long player.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're right there.
Yes. The first LP cover, which actually changed the world, was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Maybe.
And I would say that. But then again, this is from a book called A Fabulous Creation, David Hepworth. Now, do you remember going to school with an LP under your arm?
I'll tell you what I remember doing. I remember selling and exchanging quite a lot of singles, not so many albums. But
I
probably, there was a time when I started to get into albums, I guess.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, it was mostly just singles.
Right. Well, in the first opening chapter of this book, it says, at the end of the 1960s, a new phenomenon appeared in the classrooms, playgrounds and refectories of British schools. The sight of teenagers carrying pictures under their arms as they walked importantly among their peers. Mm. The pictures were 12 inches square and featured startling images. A man wearing a fish mask. Who was that?
That was Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart.
Absolutely. An eccentric hat. Or a naked pubertal girl holding a phallic aeroplane. Or a terrified pink face with a screaming mouth opened to reveal a dangling uvula. What's an uvula?
Don't know.
I don't either. I don't think it's rude.
Right.
I think it's like a an instrument or something.
Is it UV?
It's UVULA. So it's not vulva, as in women's anatomy.
I understand that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know
what an uvula is. I'll maybe look it up. Is it some kind of musical instrument?
I think it is, yeah. I was the guy who tracked down the man who invented the vuvuzela in the 2010 South African World Cup.
Oh, yeah, that was a terrible noise,
wasn't it? Yeah, terrible noise, yeah. But anyway, listen, you're absolutely right in what you said. Those LPs I've just told you about...
It's something to do with the throat, the uvula.
Is it? Okay, yeah. All right, those LPs were by... Captain Beefheart,
as you said, right.
The second one was Blind Faith.
Yes.
And the third one was King Crimson.
Yes.
Okay.
Called the Crimson King.
That's
the one with the tonsils. You know, the guy where you can see the tonsils.
Well, is that the uvula then?
Yeah, I think so.
That's the uvula.
The uvula is the part of the throat that goes around the tonsils, apparently.
Okay, fine. Anyway, this was a new world which linked everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And teenagers suddenly became patrons of the arts.
Yes.
Because, you know, depending on which LP you went, you were having a big
effect. Album covers were really, really special.
Oh, they were, yeah.
Not only were they special, but the thing about... I remember Sgt. Pepper, because I've still got the original that my dad actually bought for my sister and I.
Yeah.
Somehow, as I've said to you before, I ended up with that album.
Yes.
She ended up with the autographs.
Yes.
But inside the Sgt. Pepper album... There were all sorts of little...
It was a gatefold.
It was a gatefold, so you opened it out and there was the pictures of the four of them there.
Yeah.
But also there was all kinds of little goodies inside it.
Yeah,
so,
that's
for example, there was a paper. It was all paper.
Yes.
Like a paper moustache.
Yes.
Like Paul McCartney's one. I think there was even a paper wig.
Yeah, that's right.
So you could make yourself look like the Beatles.
Well, exactly. Well, it said that the gatefold was in the sleeve. The lyrics were printed on the back for the first time ever. But when you looked at the record, because you always used to examine the records to see how beautiful the black vinyl was, early purchasers of Sgt. Pepper's realised there were no gaps between the tracks.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, it became the first LP, became a medley.
Sort of played kind of continuously. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an album something more than the sum of its parts and the paradigm of thousands to come, okay? Mm. And then they said it just got better and better. People like the band produced... pictures on the front which looked like famous photographs from the Civil War. Yeah. Remember, they put them in sepia?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of brown, you know?
Well, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young did one like that as well.
Now, here's one that you'll like. Similar Guile attended the sale of live albums dressed up as bootleg releases such as The Who Live in Leeds.
Live at Leeds, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and that came looking as if it was...
That,
a, I never actually had a vinyl copy of Live at Leeds. Right. I think I had it on a cassette because I copied it from somebody else. But I remember the album cover very well. It's just like a brown paper wrapper.
That's right, yeah.
And it's just got Live at Leeds stamped on it.
That's right. And this was done by the music industry to try and convince gullible fans that the best music was being kept from them by the dirty capitalist overlords of music.
Right.
And that by getting an LP like that, they were breaking and broaching the system, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was funny because there was a period of time when bootlegs were really, really massive.
Yes.
And I used to go to a record shop in Bath at the time when I was living in Bath.
Yes.
And I still got it. I've got a Bruce Springsteen bootleg, which contains 6 songs on it.
Yeah.
None of which have ever been recorded anywhere else, but 2 of which are very similar to songs that he later recorded and changed the names of.
Right, okay.
And I've also got a couple of David Bowie bootlegs.
Right.
One that was recorded.
I wouldn't buy a bootleg because the quality of it's so poor, isn't it?
Yeah, but in those days it didn't matter. It was the fact that it was a live performance. There's not that many live albums got put out.
I see.
And some of the live albums were a bit too well engineered and you actually wanted it to sound crappy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know what you mean. So like that scratchy and all that.
Yeah,
McCartney lyric, and it was "When I met you at the station, you were standing with a bootleg in your hand." And
that's that song High High High.
Yeah,
I've still got that single.
Really?
And on the other side of it, it was banned, funnily enough, that song in America.
Isn't it Mary Had a Little Lamb?
No, Sea Moon.
Oh, Sea Moon, that's right. Sea
Which
Moon.
Is equally meaningless.
Sea Moon.
You know, it means nothing, but Sea Moon became a massive hit. Yeah. Because High, High, High got banned.
Really?
Yeah, because it was all about getting high.
Let me get high, high, high.
Yeah, and it was a bit dirty as well.
Now, I had a fantastic record collection.
Yeah.
And then...
So what happened to it?
Well, I'm going to tell you. And then I got called into Sir Nicholas Lloyd's office.
Oh, yeah.
And...
So this is in your adult career?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'd been collecting the records for 25 years.
Right.
So I was at the time, I was about...
30-something?
Yeah, about 38.
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah, you're absolutely
right. So you still had a lot of records when you were 38?
Loads, loads. I lived in a three-bedroomed townhouse in Banstead. Stockbroker Belt.
I think I saw it. Always I think I was there.
Were you?
I'm sure I came to Banstead.
Oh, you could have done. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when you were home from America once. Yeah. And I had, like, cupboards full of them on the ground floor.
Right.
And used to love getting them out. I mean, all sorts of things. You know, John Michael Jarret. All the Bowie hits, all the Queen, Rolling Stones, even Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
Were
you somebody who went to buy albums, or did you not really buy them very often, or did you
them? I bought whenever a new album came out by a group I liked, I bought them.
I mean, I've just seen, for example, it's funny you should say this, I've just been on the tube to come here, and I've just seen a great big poster, and I said, a very striking looking woman. I thought, who's that? And it's Dido.
Right.
Remember Dido?
Not really, no.
She's one of these kind of... she was kind of the precursor to somebody like Adele.
Right, okay.
You know, but she's quite interesting, does some quite good stuff. Went to Camden School for Girls.
Right.
It's all very London, you know.
Yeah.
She's got a new album out.
Right.
Now, the first thing I'm going to do when I get home is I'm going to go on Spotify and I'm going to see if I can play it.
Okay.
But I won't have an album to hold.
No, no.
I won't have any artwork to look at.
No, no.
It'll just be the music.
That's right.
And I kind of miss that, really.
And, of course, so do the artists, because they only get 89p for a downloaded album.
It's true.
They used to get, you know, £3 or £4 for an album sold in the shops.
So they might get more downloads than they would have sold albums, though.
Maybe, you could be right. Anyway, so
you got called into Sir Nicholas's office.
Yes, that's right, yeah. You know, and it was actually Wendy who...
Wendy?
Who came down
She who has never been named before.
She was the editor secretary, so she came down and said...
Yeah, but you've never normally named her, though.
Well, it was her job as a secretary, and we all had jobs, didn't we, and all that kind of stuff, you know. So she said, the editor would like to see her. Yeah, okay, fine. Middle of a working day.
Yeah, yeah.
Thought she was going to tell me how brilliant I was again, you know. And
or another bollocking.
No, no, never used to get bollockings. That's the thing about Nick. He never bollocked anybody, no matter how bad they'd done something. Paul Dacre over at the Mail used to bollock people 3 or 4 times.
Even if they hadn't done anything wrong.
Even if they hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And in fact,
he used to throw pens at them.
Yeah, and you know what? You know the C word, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, apparently, under Dacre, you'd go into his office, and if he was like mildly irritated with you, you were a C.
Yeah.
But if he really thought you hadn't done much, you know,
you
were a double C.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to tell you, you know, you are a seeing C.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was quite, you know.
They used to call it the vagina monologues.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they did.
Because that was all he ever said.
That's right. But anyway, I go in to see Nick, and he'd just come back from lunch. He'd obviously gone out to get some, you know...
Dutch courage,
yeah. And he said, oh, hello, Michael. He said, oh, it's all, yeah. I said, yeah, all right, Nick, look, a bit busy. I said, you know, got to get on with it. Yeah, just sit down for a minute, you know, and then shut the door, you know. And
did he offer you a drink?
No, he didn't at this stage. Mm. He'd just come back for lunch about 3:30, you know. Yeah. I want to make some changes. I said, do you? Okay, great. Well, it's good of you to take me into your confidence, Nick. I agree. There's a lot of wankers out there, you know, and we must.
You hadn't quite caught on at this point.
Not at all, no. I hadn't realised how pale he'd gone, you know.
No.
And I said, I'm all with you. I said, and by the way, I'll bring you, let me get the paper out of the way. I'll bring you a list and perhaps you could have a drink and talk about it. No, you don't understand. I said, what do I understand? I understand everything, Kieran. You know, I want to reposition you.
Right.
I said, reposition me? I said, what are you talking about, Nick? You know, I do want to make changes. I said, sorry, you're talking about me? Yes.
Right.
And it's all because I'd had a row with Heather McGlone.
Heather McGlone, yeah.
And I used to call David Richardson a tosspot.
Right.
He was the foreign editor, because he was, you know. Right. And people thought this was rather too strong.
Yes. Well, this was the beginning of the new management age, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Where you couldn't start referring to people like that anymore.
That's right, yeah. And I said, I was shocked. I mean, I was so shocked. I started shaking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Shaking?
Yeah.
Blimey.
Sort of trembling, right. You know. And,
well, this had been your life for what, 5 years or something?
I'd been the news editor for 5.5 years. Yeah. So I came back down to the desk, even though it was 3:30.
Yeah.
And I said to Mr. Walker, you know, I said, Ian, come on.
Did he tell you that he was giving Walker your job?
I suggested it. Right. As soon as he said, I said, well, I'm only going to agree not to make a huge fuss of this. Yeah. And he said, yeah, it was only about a 5-minute conversation. Yeah. You know. Well, they offered me a big payoff or back to America, right? To do the Clinton election campaign, you know. So Nick tried to, you know, only one person can do the Clinton election campaign. Said, no, Nick, 50 fucking people do the election campaign. Only one person can get the paper out every day with the energy and dynamism that I bring in, you know. I said, this is pathetic, you know. And I said, and by the way, I'm not going anywhere unless you give it a Walker, you know. Oh, yeah, well, on a temporary basis and all that.
Yeah.
So I came back down to the desk, you know. I must have looked shocked.
Yeah.
And I said, come on, go now. And remember, we had 5 people on the desk in those days. You had all those half-bakes like Jim Watson, John McCormick.
Right. None of them were really fucking good.
None of them were really good. But fortunately, Gordon Docker was there. Gordon
was all right, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, well, I said, no, we're going. Come on, just get your coat, you know. So you could see there was something going on. And I said, Gordon, listen, mate, Ian and I have got something urgent. We've got to sort out at the behest of the editor. Just get through conference, will you? He'd never done conference before, I found out later, you know. So, so we went to the wine bar next door, you know, the one down the stairs. And anyway, so that was on the particular day. So then the shock set in. So then I thought.
So was it with immediate effect?
Well, it was certainly within
I mean, those things kind of are, aren't they? Because you can't say, I want you to leave in a month.
No.
You just have to fucking do it.
No, it was within a few days. It was within a few days. So,
but I presume you didn't come back in and news edit the paper, is what I mean.
I did, I think, for Thursday and Friday.
Did you?
I think this was a Wednesday.
See, I don't think I would have bothered.
Well, you have to try and leave with a bit of dignity or something, you know what I mean? So I was then on gardening leave, ahead of going back to America.
Right.
But
did you have to go and have a word with David Richardson?
No, I didn't bother to toss us like him, you know what I mean? But... but no, the point was that I thought it was actually the first time I rented out a house. Mm. It was my house.
Right.
I had a couple of little flats.
Okay.
But I hadn't.
Oh, well, you rented out your place in Benston?
Yeah.
Right.
And so the person came round and said, well, you know, you should clear it of all your own personal effects, leave the furniture, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So I opened the cupboard with all my LPs in. You bastard, you know. I'm not going to be playing for the next 12 months. Nobody else is, you know.
Right.
So I put them all in my car and I drove to the tip and I threw the whole collection into the skip. Yeah.
You fucking idiot.
I was so angry
and
so bitterly hurt and upset that Nick Lloyd thought he could fucking end my newspaper career like this.
Right.
I just literally said, I don't want them. And they were beautiful.
Right.
And they were all in excellent. I remember the last one I saw flying into the skip was David Bowie, you know, Life on Mars or something, you know what I mean? And so I spent years regretting that, obviously. But
see, because I've always lost a bit, various chunks of my record collection, which used to be about 200.
Yeah.
And it's now down to probably about 45 or something like that.
Yeah.
But I've still got the 45.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I'm never going to get rid of them.
Well, what's happened is over the years, a chap sent me the whole Beatles collection, both in stereo and mono. I've still got those.
Okay.
But last Christmas, not the one just gone, the Christmas before, Sgt. Pepper's came out in a box set in which you got, you know, an original copy of the LP, or they must have made them again, obviously, but a perfect copy.
Yeah.
The booklet, all the things that you've been talking about, the false moustache and all that, came in a box set. And a few other things since then. I don't really mind about the records anymore, to be honest, because, as you quite rightly say now, they're all available on Spotify. So they're just really objet d'art.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes, because I've got a turntable.
And they're locked
now,
away in cupboards.
Because I've still got a turntable, I will sometimes, you know, of an evening, think, I'm going to just play a couple of albums.
Yes.
And it's quite a nice thing to do.
Yes, I agree.
It's a sort of, you know, it's different.
Yeah, I would like to.
And it sounds different as well, because the sound that they produce is very, very un-electronic, if you like, if you know what I mean. I mean, I've got loads of, I mean, funnily enough, I've got loads of CDs that I noticed that I'd forgotten I had.
Oh, I've got hundreds.
And I've got nothing to play them on.
I've got hundreds of CDs.
I literally, because I've got no CD player in the car.
Can't play on a laptop?
Well, I could, but I can't. Not on my laptop's a MacBook Air, which doesn't have a slot for a CD.
No, I see. Okay,
The only thing I think I might be able to play them on is my DVD player.
You can still go into Curry's, you know.
And, oh, I could buy one,
and you can still buy a CD player.
Yeah, no, I know, I know, but I don't have one.
No,
you know, I mean, what I used to do is play them in. I used to keep them and play them in the car.
That's right. Yeah,
but my new car does not have a CD player.
Mine doesn't either. I totally agree.
So I hook my phone up.
Yeah.
And I listen to Spotify.
But anyway, another chapter of our life gone by. But still, look at the picture that comes with the book.
Yeah.
The Beatles at their best in their Sgt. Pepper's gear.
Mm.
George Harrison looking particularly sort of bohemian. You know what I mean? Fantastic. So
it is
another. I mean, I was far, far more upset when I lost my football programme collection than when I threw my LPs out, because I lost that by accident.
Yeah,
I've rebuilt most of that. I'm so sad. I went to programme fairs for the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, we might have to talk about that.
And try to rebuy all the programmes I'd lost, you know.
Well, we might have to make another podcast about that.
Yeah,
because we're out of time. This is On The Record, though, with the two mics.
That's the thing about Nick. He never bollocked anybody, no matter how bad they'd done through. Paul Dacre over at the Mail used to bollock people 3 or 4 times.
Even if they hadn't done anything wrong.
Even if they hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And
he used to throw pens at them.
Yeah. And you know what? You know the C word, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, apparently, under Dacre, you'd go into his office, and if he was, like, mildly irritated with you, you were a C.
Yeah.
But if he really thought you hadn't done much, you were a double C.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to tell you, you know, you are a seeing C.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was quite, you know.
They used to call it the vagina monologues.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
because that was all he ever said.
That's right. And so the person came round and said, well, you know, you should clear it of all your own personal effects, leave the furniture, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So I opened the cupboard with all my LPs in. You bastard, you know. I'm not going to be playing for the next 12 months. Nobody else's, you know.
Right.
So I put them all in my car and I drove to the tip and I threw the whole collection into the skip. Yeah.
You fucking idiot.
I was so angry
and
so bitterly hurt and upset that Nick Lloyd thought he could fucking end my newspaper career like this.
Right.
I just literally said, I don't want them. And they were beautiful.
Right.
And they were all in excellent. I remember the last one I saw flying into the skip was David Bowie, you know, Life on Mars or something, you know what I mean?
Did you have to go and have a word with David Richardson?
No, I didn't bother talking to tossers like him, you know what I mean?